Chris Murphy, always wonderful to have you. United States Senator, we always say around here, we knew him when, and we're just delighted. So the question is, you're pushing a Mental Health Reform Act in the Senate. Now, this stuff has been around for a while. I was an NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health Fellow, for my PhD. So I studied this stuff
Wow.
for a long time and wrote on it. And we keep talking about all of those things that ought to be changed, but we haven't seen the kind of progress this country should, right?
So it's a great question why that hasn't happened, because this issue affects everybody. Everybody knows somebody in your immediate family or your neighborhood that's been deeply affected by mental illness, maybe somebody who has a serious mental illness, and everybody's got a horror story about how they've been ill-served by the system. How you were warehoused in an emergency room, you couldn't find a clinician to cover you, your insurance company denied your care. And so why doesn't something happen? Well, part of it is because our behavioral health and mental health system is siloed. It's compartmentalized, right? There's no one level of government, nor one section of our healthcare system that runs it. There's a little bit at the federal level. There's a little bit in the private sector. There's a little bit at the state level. Some mental health is in mental health clinics. Some of it is in hospitals. Some of it's in emergency rooms. Some of it's in schools, right? So it makes it very hard to do a comprehensive reform. And so Congress has largely shied away from it. So Bill Cassidy, who's a conservative Republican from the Deep South from Louisiana, but a clinician and somebody who's got a son with dyslexia, not a mental illness, but he's sort of seen the obstacles that are presented when you try to get services for somebody that's got needs. He and I get together at the beginning of last year and we say, let's try to do the unthinkable. Let's build a comprehensive mental health reform bill. And let's do it in a really bipartisan way. And that's what we did. We asked everybody, clinicians, patients, parents, advocates, give us all your suggestions on how to make this system make more sense. We built that bill. We've moved it through the process. I can talk to you about the details, Alan, but we're hopeful that by the end of this year, in the lame duck session, we're going to be able to get it passed. And we think the result will be, for the first time, a lot of these inadequacies in our mental health and behavioral health system will get fixed.
Do you think that the fact that so many of these guys who have gone completely crazy, with their guns and wiping out, I don't have to tell you about Sandy Hook of all people, that maybe some of that could have been prevented if we had a decent mental health system?
I think that's, one of the toughest questions here. And I think it's important to sort of understand what the data tells us. The data tells us that the United States doesn't have any greater incidence of mental illness than any other country in the world. It doesn't tell us that we have a less adequate mental health system than any other country in the world. It doesn't show that Americans in our DNA are more prone to violence than those people in any other country. So you can't explain America's gun violence problem through mental illness. America's gun violence problem is a function of a country that is awash in guns, that has a celebratory culture of dangerous military-style assault weapons. We should fix our mental health system because it's broken, period, stop, because there are millions of Americans who aren't getting the mental health resources that they need. But we shouldn't pretend that that is the key to fix our gun violence epidemic. I'm not going to say it won't help, because there are pathways to guns that lead through mental illness. But if you don't solve our gun problem, then you aren't going to solve our gun violence problem.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the Supreme Court. We touched on it in our last conversation. You're sitting there. If it was the other way around, I guarantee you, if the Republicans couldn't get a chance to name somebody because the Democrats were saying we're going to stall this thing, they'd be yelling up or down, right?
Of course, yeah. And I never, like to suggest that there isn't sometimes political tit for tat, but this is unprecedented. Democrats would not have done what Republicans have done, would not have blocked even a hearing on a Supreme Court justice for as long as they have. This is really troubling, really unprecedented, and it's not the end. I think Republicans are going to continue to object to whoever President Clinton puts up, notwithstanding the fact that they said over and over again during the last year that they wanted the electorate to weigh in, that they wanted the American people to decide in the presidential election what kind of nominee should be sent to the Congress for the Supreme Court.
Well, let me talk to you a little bit about Syria for a moment. It looks like this is never going to come to any kind of resolution. What are your thoughts?
Well, it will come to a resolution, but we have to step back and understand what we're in the midst of. This isn't just about Syria. This is about a major reordering of the Middle East that essentially dates back to the fall of the Ottoman Empire. We're in a process of reordering political power bases, borders, that is going to take a very long time to settle. And I just think here in the United States, we have to be sober about the impact that we can have from across the other side of the world. I really do worry that, you know, our military intervention in Syria, limited as it has been over the course of the last 2 years, has made things worse, not better. And there are times when we have to recognize hubris. We have it a lot in this country when we think that America and America alone can fix things. In Syria, listen, there will be a settlement there, but it may actually take longer to achieve the more military hardware from the United States that gets thrown into that fire.
I want to go from there to an ancillary question, which is, we're now hearing reports about the tension, including the nuclear tension, between the United States and, of all places, Russia. What do you make of it?
Well, I think you have to sort of start inside Russia and understand that, you know, Putin's at a very unstable moment in the history of his regime. The economy is, you know, on the brink of collapse. Oil prices have dramatically fallen. He's got kind of a, you know, corrupt oligarchy that's rotting from inside. And, you know, what holds him in power right now is a fierce nationalism and a fierce anti-Americanism. And so all of the things that he's doing, right, trying to tap into American elections, trying to, you know, poke at us wherever he can in Ukraine and Syria, you know, it all is first and foremost for internal purposes. He can't stop the inexorable decline of the Russian economy, and he frankly probably can't stop one way or another his ultimate fall from power. But for the time being, he's trying to prop himself up by, you know, presenting America as this boogeyman that unites Russians together. So, you know, I think that just means we have to play the long game here and understand, as we did in the Cold War, that eventually things will sort itself out. But he's going to be a big nuisance, you know, in a major way for the time being.
Is he stupid enough to actually resort to using a nuclear weapon, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, one of the reasons that I get so nervous about Donald Trump's talk about walking away from the NATO alliance or walking away from some of our treaty alliances in Asia is because I'm not confident that Vladimir Putin wouldn't make a major, major mistake. And so I think our alliances that are built to buffer against the potential nuclear threat from Russia are more important now than ever.
The old saying is, once a KGB colonel, always a KGB colonel. We can only hope that he has some of the same intellectual capacity that his predecessors in the old Soviet Union did.
Listen, I think, you know, this is a guy we've always assumed is ultimately a rational actor, that all of what he's doing is in furtherance of some agenda we don't agree with, but that ultimately we're dealing with someone who is, you know, reckless but rational. I'm not sure that we, you know, can continue with that assumption any longer. That's why these alliances are more important today than ever before.
Always love to talk to Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. Thank you for coming to our microphones and talking to us, Chris. And when we come back the next time, let's talk about a potential Clinton administration.
Great.